The serve, sliced, backhand return. Rafa with a backhand volley, and it's over. Game, set, and match. His third U.S. Open Men's Singles Championship.
Sloan from deep beyond the baseline plays a backhand. Keys a forehand. Sloan just hammering away. Now steps into a forehand. It hangs over. Forehand netted by Keys, and Sloan Stephens is the 2017 U.S. Open champion. A warm hug at the net between the two friends.
Here comes a big smile with Sloan. She can't believe it.
Welcome everyone to episode 12 of Courtside, the official podcast of the US Open. I'm Nick McCarville, and I'm actually courtside right now at the All England Club. It's that golden time of the season when we're between the French Open, the red clay, and the green grass of Wimbledon before tennis moves to the US Open Series and the hard courts at the US Open. It's quick and it's fast, the move from Roland Garros to Wimbledon, and in just a few days' time, the green grass will take center stage, center court, and much more here for the championships, which is celebrating 150 years. We have a special guest on this episode. He's a 1995 US Open quarterfinalist, and he made a famous run to the semifinals at the Australian Open in 1991. He's also part of the famous McEnroe family and himself a very well-known and well-regarded tennis coach. It's Patrick McEnroe. He's going to be on this episode talking all things Wimbledon to help us preview the tournament. But as we continue to celebrate 50 years of the US Open, we do so with a player who dominated the final day of the tournament like no other. Yvonne Lendl's remarkable streak of 8 consecutive finals during the 80s was highlighted by 3 consecutive championships.
86, 87 were my best years. I wouldn't go and say I was extremely confident defending the title. I didn't even look at it like I'm defending the title. There is nothing you can do about the past, whether it's good or bad. There is only things you can do about your future. So why worry about the past?
That's to look forward to after our chat with Patrick McEnroe. It's Steve Flink, our very own Hall of Famer, talking with another Hall of Famer in Yvonne Lendl. Now, the U.S. Open has a new look, and now you can too. Head to usopenshop.com to be the first of your friends to have new U.S. Open gear, t-shirts, hats, and much more now available. That's usopenshop.com. We've got the U.S. Open Series and the U.S. Open to look forward to, the 50th anniversary of the Open era at the U.S. Open. And let's bring in our chat just last week, a few days ago, with Patrick McEnroe. Well, first off, tell me your day-to-day, because we're actually on Randall's Island just outside of Manhattan, and this is, I think you have an office nearby. Tell people what you've been up to, because they obviously know your name, they know your commentary work, but there's more to your life right now than just that.
Well, this is where I'm spending most of my time these days, here at our academy at Randall's Island, and since I left the USTA job about a year and a half, 2 years ago, I started here about a little over a year ago, and I'm actually really loving it. I'm really enjoying it. Spend most of my time when I'm here actually on the court, working with kids and working with the coaches. And my job when I was running player development was not really that type of job. It was more administrative and more of a leadership type of role. So I didn't really spend that much time on the court. So I have to say that I'm really enjoying it. I've learned a lot about working with young kids, especially, and how to develop young kids, and from a lot of different coaches as well. So I'm here pretty much every afternoon. I get here usually in the early afternoon. During the fall, I'm here till 8 p.m. every night. Our season just ended just here. Now we're into our summer program, so we have summer camp and lessons and things like that. So it's been a really nice place for me to call my home away from home.
Yeah, kind of maybe a little bit full circle too for you to go back and actually get to spend time on the tennis court.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, my daughter is quite a pretty good 12 and under player, so she's here all the time, and she loves it. And so I get to spend a lot of time with her. She was here earlier today and went home to relax and enjoy her start of her summer. And my two other girls, who are twins, who are 9, play a little, dabble in tennis, but they do they do other things. So it's been a nice spot for me. I get to see my brother a lot, which is when he's around. So that's been fun. And we don't always agree, believe it or not, on how to develop kids.
Shocker.
But that's actually kind of fun because we sort of hash it out and we both express our opinions and, you know, really working together to try to make this the best place it can be. And there's a lot of great kids here, and we have a great scholarship program for kids. In fact, I've been meeting last month or so with a lot of the parents of the scholarship kids and talking about, you know, next year for them and what they like, what they don't like, and just plugging away and trying to make it as good of a tennis facility and academy as we can for kids.
Patrick, I think there'll be plenty of listeners who know the John McEnroe Tennis Academy, but can you kind of detail, you know, numbers? And I think Noah Rubin was training here for a while, but this is a big operation.
Yeah, it's a big operation. Nice, we're at a great facility. We've got 20 courts. They're now all, or 15 of them are now outdoor, but we bubble them during the course of the year. We have 5 permanent indoor hard courts. We have 5 other hard courts and 10 clay courts. Great gym. We're right here by all the fields here on Randall's Island, so we can use the soccer fields and things like that for kids to play and run around. And this is really the premier tennis facility in the area. So we've got over probably 700 to 800 kids through the course of the whole year and all the different programs that play here. We've got kids that are, you know, really high level national and Eastern ranked players to people that play once a week, you know, and come and play for fun and take lessons, etc. It's also a pretty bustling academy a tennis facility for adults, you know, that do adult leagues and people that play on the weekends. So it's an incredibly busy place. It's a big operation, and I have more coaches at work here than I did in my years at the USTA.
Wow.
So when I was with the USTA, I think we had about maybe mid-20s in coaches, and here there's almost 40 coaches. So when you see them, and they're from all over the world, as you would expect in tennis. So we have coaches from Croatia, from India, from Germany, from France, from Argentina. And so it's a real melting pot. And we have kids from all over the city area and also from Queens and from Westchester and Long Island, and a lot of kids with different backgrounds. The Johnny Mack Tennis Project, which is sort of our scholarship program, is we fund the kids to come and train here. So one of John's, obviously, goals when he started this place about 8 years ago was to give kids that didn't have the opportunity to, the financial opportunity and wherewithal to play tennis and get into tennis, to have a place to come. So we work really hard on raising money and trying to support those kids. And then we also have, obviously, our paying customers as well, which help, you know, support the whole academy and the whole program.
Okay, so we're actually recording this. We're 10 days out from Wimbledon. You're going to help us preview what's to come at Wimbledon. But when you guys, because ESPN doesn't have the French Open, obviously you're a tennis fan. You're watching no matter what. We were just talking about you were in Paris watching some of the tennis. I think you were in person watching both the men's and women's final. But when you sort of have that little bit of time off out of the commentary booth, how are you keeping track of the tour, and how are you getting ready to go back and into that?
Well, I always keep tabs on what's going on, so that's sort of become I'm used to that my whole life. So don't tell my bosses at ESPN, but I do watch Tennis Channel, so I keep, you know, and they do a great job. So I always enjoy, you know, all those people, most of whom I know pretty well. I watch you and all the stuff you do with the various majors, which is tremendous, and at the French as well. So I try to keep tabs on it. You know, I obviously don't think that going there for the weekend was something I would do on my own, but I had some other business to try to actually raise money for our scholarship program here. But it was kind of fun.
This was in Paris.
Yeah, in Paris. I did go to Paris for the final weekend, and I watched both finals live in the crowd. So it was kind of nice to be there and just sitting and, you know, like all the the highfalutin people do, you know, get a nice drink, get some food. You know,
did
like
you get one of those hats.
Yeah,
one of the French
you know, they
hats.
Offered me a hat, but I declined.
You didn't
take it? I declined. Oh. It wasn't quite
unforced
my look.
Error.
Yeah, unforced error. I was never that good on clay. So. But it was great to be there. It was actually nice to see the changes they've made and the changes they have coming for the facility.
A lot.
So that's exciting. For I know they've worked long and hard to try to make that happen. So was really happy for Simona Halep. I mean, she really dug deep. I thought Sloane played amazing the first set in a couple games and was outplaying her. But Halep just, you know, she persevered And, you know, credit to her because she's lost some, you know, really tough matches. And so I was glad to see her get that win. And, you know, Sloane, I think, is tremendous. And I think she has a huge upside still to get to the – well, she's close to the top already. But I think she could really – I think she could get to number one if she really just tightens up a couple things in her game. But, you know, watching her was great. Oh, it was a really good match. And then, you know, Rafa is Rafa. I mean, this, you know, it's Federer. People come up to me now. Even somebody came up to me today. How's anybody going to beat? I mean, Federer is a heavy favorite going into Wimbledon. Nadal just absolutely dominated, you know, the clay court season. Federer did the same at the Australian and, you know, got pushed a little bit in the final, but basically walked through it. So it's, I mean, nobody would have predicted that these two guys would, after what Djokovic did and then where Murray was, that, like, you know, a couple of years later they'd be back just trading off winning majors and major titles again. So I guess we're going to it's going to continue. Let's enjoy it. We'll still wait and see if someone else can break through. But it's hard to see that at Wimbledon, the way that Roger looks now. We'll find out.
Well, it's a nice segue to talk about Roger being the top seed, being the world number one heading into Wimbledon. I was talking about it with some colleagues the other day as well. It almost feels like something catastrophic would have to happen in sort of the perfect storm, the way we talk about Rafa at the French.
Right.
Do you feel like Roger's in that position at Wimbledon?
I don't think he's quite as dominant as Nadal is on clay. And that's just because of the surface. And, you know, because Nadal, I mean, I remember watching even the first couple of games in the final against Thiem, who was arguably the second best clay court player this season.
Yeah.
And after watching like 3-4 games, I'm like, how do you win points against this guy? Like on club, when he's playing at this level, like how do you literally win points? And Thiem, you know, was able to win a few games, but on grass, you know, it's more of it's not quite a crapshoot, but, you know, somebody could get hot, somebody could serve big.
Stachowski.
Yeah, I mean, there are guys that can pick him off. So I don't think he's definitely a huge favorite. But, you know, you think of a Del Potro or Cilic. I mean, you know, those guys can serve massively and hit the ball huge. So there are guys out there, I think, that could threaten him. Early on, you know, it's hard to think who could do that. And obviously as the courts get more solid later on, you know, and Roger gets more comfortable, it's probably tougher to take him out. But I think it's not – it wouldn't shock me to see him lose at Wimbledon. It would surprise me, but it wouldn't shock me. And in Nadal, it's like he's like not. There's like no way it's going to happen
on clay.
Because it's just the nature of the surface and the way the game is played. But I think there are some guys that if they get hot in the first couple of days when the grass is, you know, a little soft, that could give Roger some trouble.
I thought it was funny that as soon as Roger wins Stuttgart, it was title number 98. Everyone's talking. Now, again, we don't know what's going to happen
in Halle,
the next few days in Halle,
right,
but
that's right.
Everyone goes to, wow, Wimbledon number 100.
Right. That would be pretty cool.
No pressure, Rog.
Yeah, I mean, he seems to like love all that kind of stuff, and I think that's, look, we've talked about this before. This is part of his brilliance and part of his greatness is that he loves the game. He loves the, you know, the records he's breaking, the history he's making, that sort of inspires him. But in a way, you'd think that people like would get nervous or something, but he seems to just enjoy it. He takes it in. And I used to marvel when he used to lose in big matches, and I used to say, God, he just seems like he doesn't really care. Like he just rubs, you know, it goes off his back. And, you know, it turned out that he was way smarter than any of us ever could have imagined because he never got rattled. He never panicked. You know, even when people said, like, he's going down and how could he, you know, he's got the issues with the back and then the knee. And somehow he just was calm about it. And even when he suffered some surprising losses or, you know, really tough losses in huge matches, you know, he came right back. So, and I think that's partly why in his mid to late 30s, he still can play at this level and enjoy it as much as he does.
What's been in the last 18 months as he's won two AOs, Wimbledon as well, gotten back to number one.
Yeah.
What's the thing from your tennis eye that you've been most impressed with by him? And then Patrick, as people watch him at Wimbledon, what's the one thing, what's the one part of his game that makes him so dangerous on the grass?
Well, he's so quick and he's just so explosive the way he moves, but he does it in a way that looks so relaxed. The two things that about his game, you know, that really were amazing to me that went to another level when he beat Rafa in the Australian final last year, you know, attacking the backhand as much as he did, being unafraid to just go after it, you know, to just really flatten it out and hit it up the line more and just do more damage with it. And his second serve. I think his second serve got a lot better with the new racket. And once he got comfortable and used to that, it was harder for, you know, guys to attack. Because there's a time when, I'm not going to say his second serve was weak, but guys could sort of step in and take some shots at it. And so I think those two shots are what sort of have helped him these last couple of years. But the overall thing that I marvel with him about is his movement. You know, just that he can continue. Because the shot making and the talent in the hand and the hand-eye coordination doesn't really go away, even if you get a little bit older. What goes away is the movement and the ability to get to the ball and to get to, you know, tough balls in awkward positions. So that is just remarkable to me, how he can continue to move at such a high level. He's looking to move more offensively now than he did when he was in his mid-20s. You go back to some of his matches that he won, you know, Baghdadis in the Aussie Open final when he was struggling for a set and a half. You know, he won a lot of those matches just on defending, you know, getting himself, like, keeping himself in points. And now he uses that quick strike ability to sort of take the ball on quicker and do it more offensively more often. And I think that's a part of his genius over the last 5-6 years is that he's not relying on defending as much, but he's using his speed in a more efficient way. And I think that's why he's been able to, you know, dominate and improve as he's gotten into his service. You know, he's gotten better in some areas, which is just ridiculous to think about.
Well, we didn't get a lot of the talk in Australia again this year was that perhaps we were going to get a Roger and Rafa again. Obviously, that didn't happen because of the retirement for Rafa. The grass offers so many different challenges for Rafa, obviously coming off that 11th French Open title. Remember him losing to Gilles Muller last year, 16-14. Right. I think it was fourth round in the fifth set. But can Rafa factor in this tournament? It always feels to me, Patrick, like the first couple matches.
Yeah, no, you're right. The first week is tricky for him, and he's obviously susceptible to being picked off by someone like a Muller that can serve big and take the ball early and, you know, put him under pressure. So, you know, the rumblings I'm hearing are that he may not even play, which to me wouldn't be a huge surprise because I think not only has Wimbledon been tricky for him, you know, he hasn't really done much there since the last time he won it, which is a while now, but he seems to get beat up when he goes there, which you'd think doesn't really make sense because you always people say, well, grass is a more unforgiving type of surface. But for Rafa, it's, I think, very problematic because he doesn't like the quick movement and the slipping and the uncertainty of grass court tennis. And that's where that his type of movement is a very aggressive, very physical type of move. And he's perfected that, obviously, on clay and even on hard court now where, you know, the hard courts used to bug him, but now he's adapted his body and he knows what to expect as far as movement. And I think on grass, he doesn't. And I think that, you know, that's why his knees and his hips and his back. And so I could see him, you know, especially after the clay court season he had, I could see him pulling out and just sort of getting ready for the Open. But I think that depends on if he believes he can win it, you know, because I think if he believes he could actually win it, and he is feeling, you know, fresh, that he could win it if he got into the second week. You know, once he could get to past the first week and the courts get a little more solid, the footing gets better, you're not slipping as much, then I think he could become a factor. But I think there's a lot of players that would go out there against him thinking they could beat him.
Yeah, there was a long time, Patrick, that we, you know, the big four dominated the way that Roger, Rafa, Andy Novak, you could throw Stan in there a little bit.
Right.
But that second group, Andy, Novak, and Stan, I think Djokovic feels a little more back established, making the run that he did at Roland Garros disappointing the way that ended. But he's back inside the top 25, whereas you've got Andy, who played his first match in almost a year.
Right.
But for those three guys, they'll be looming dangers in a way if in fact Andy does end up playing.
Yeah, I mean, I think Djokovic is looking pretty good. I mean, he's definitely looked
destroyed Dimitrov today.
Yeah, so I think he looks like and it started to see signs of it in the clay court season where it was starting to come back around. So is that enough to win it? You know, it could be. I mean, he's I definitely give him a much better shot than either Stan or Murray. So I think Murray at this point, you know, is just he's going to be happy if he can even play.
Yeah,
it was great to see him back, and he looked good against Kyrgios. But obviously, physically, he's not anywhere near, you know, playing best of five consistently. So. I wouldn't expect to see him go deep. But I think Djokovic is, you know, he's too good of a player. I mean, people say, is he ever going to get it back? I mean, is he ever going to get back to winning 2-3 majors a year? Probably not. But he's too good not to, you know, if he's got to just get his head on and get his mind right. You know, to me, he's too good of a player not to win more majors.
It's been fascinating to watch sort of his slow build back, because I think Rafa and Roger, in a way, Roger especially, sort of made it look easy,
right?
Taking that time off, but
that's true.
Novak has gone through it a little bit.
He's had to go through it. He's had to be humbled, and he's had to, you know, sort of struggle through it. And but it seems like he's sort of on the other side now. So it'll be good for tennis, obviously, to have him back in the mix. And I think there's some other guys, like, you know, Dimitrov's another guy who I thought, you know, a number of years ago when he beat Murray, you know, I said that this guy's going to win Wimbledon. He looked like he had that kind of game. So he's been disappointing for me at Wimbledon, at least at Wimbledon. Obviously, like I said, a couple of decent Australians and the year-end championships was great. But overall, I expected more from him on the grass. That's been – but his serve has been a huge detriment and doesn't, you know, look a lot better at the moment. So, you know, second serve – vulnerability on grass is not where you want to have that, especially. Team Zverev, you know, I don't think grass is that suited for them. So I wouldn't expect them to go super deep. Americans, you know, Sock's been a major disappointment this year after a great...
Why is that?
I think he's just not 100% committed. You know, he's just not fit enough, in my opinion. He doesn't look like he's in amazing shape. And he got just... You know, probably it was amazing. He was amazed how well he did the end of the last year. You know, he finished with 7-8 in the world, had a great year-end championships, and he didn't build on it. You know, I think he just kind of, like, gloated or just sat back and thought, okay, you know, this is a great run. But he got a little bit lucky, you know, to have that run in Paris. And, you know, the difference between being, like, 7-8 in the world and being 25 is not that big. As you're seeing with some of these players. So if you lose a little bit of that edge, if you're not Nadal or Federer, you know, it can disappear pretty quickly. So, you know, there's time. He's still youngish. I hope he can get it back together. I think he can. You know, Isner has never played great at Wimbledon. The returning and the movement's difficult for him.
Yeah.
Query is probably the guy with the best shot, on grass to do
semis
well.
Semis last year.
You know, Tiafoe's had a nice couple wins this week, so I think he's got the athleticism and, you know, some shot-making ability, so it'd be nice to see him. Fritz, you know, movement's an issue, but, you know, at least we got some guys to talk about. But if I had to say the guy with the best shot to make some, would probably be Query.
Yeah, just because of the way his game
plays. Yeah, and he seems comfortable, and he moves pretty, for his size, he moves well. Much better mover on grass than Isner. You know, whereas Isner's more effective when the ball sits up and he's got a little bit of time.
I mentioned, obviously, that the Big Four has evaporated, at least for now. It's funny, too, because for a while there was that second group where we could rely on, say, a Raonic or a Nishikori, or Dimitrov you were talking
those
about.
Guys, yeah.
But that's gone, in a sense, at least for now, as well. So, you know, even when I was prepping to talk to you, there doesn't really feel like that reliable second group on the men's side to say, you know, who might knock Roger off.
Well, Raonic is definitely dangerous.
If he stays healthy.
Yeah, exactly. It's a big if. But, I mean, certainly he had a good tournament. Where did he lose to in the final?
Stuttgart, Roger.
Yeah. So he looks like, you know, he's I think he pulled out of Queens with more precautionary reasons, which was probably smart.
Yep.
So out of those guys, you know, Nishikori's been hurt a lot, so I don't expect him to be a factor. Dimitrov, we talked about. You know, the next group is really Zverev and team, and, you know, Čorić making a little noise, Khachanov. That guy could be dangerous on grass. There's a couple of, you know, those younger guys out there. Rublev's was out for a little bit.
Shapovalov,
you Sissipas. Know, dangerous. Yeah, Tsitsipas has been a nice story this,
Nick
this
Kyrgios.
Season. Yeah. Well, Kyrgios is a question. I mean, he could certainly win it.
Yep.
But I just don't know if physically he's strong enough. I mean, it's always the same thing with him. It's like, does he physically have the strength to play a five setter, you know, in the second round, or play a tough four setter and then come back and be able to go up against a, you know, a Federer or someone like, okay, now you got to now it's go time. You know, now it's best of five. You know, can I actually do this? So I don't think he's never proven that he can do that. And up until this point, he's proven he can go beat Federer and, you know, two out of three, and play someone close and beat Rafa, you know, in Cincinnati. That we know he can do. But to back it up in a major, he hasn't proved that. He's got the game on grass that he could be a huge factor, but, you know, the game's so physical now. So if you don't have the work put in, the miles in the tank, on the court, off the court, training, et cetera, you basically have no shot.
So before I ask you for your winner, or who you think might win Wimbledon, we didn't mention Juan Martín Del Potro or Marin Cilic, who both, I mean,
I think Delpo and Cilic, both those guys are could be factors.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, I think the movement for them is, you know, again, it's not as sure footing as a hard court. So it's a little different for those guys. But again, get into week two and the footing gets a little bit better. The ball sits up a little bit more, you know, so it gets in their strike zone more. The slice, not as big of a factor maybe in week two. Both those guys could be in the final weekend, absolutely. And they certainly have the firepower, you know, to overpower Federer, you know, a little bit the way Sanga did, you know, that one year. Sanga just came and blasted serves, blasted forehands, and just, you know, out-muscled Roger. And so those guys are capable of doing that, but they're also capable of losing in the first couple of rounds.
Right.
You know, 'cause I don't consider them like pure grass court players, and that they move well and they get on the grass. You know, it takes them, I think, a lot of reps and some matches to feel comfortable, and the surface to be a little more solid for them to be really comfortable out there.
So is Roger your winner?
Well, Roger is a winner. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine. I mean, you can't pick anybody else. I mean, the only other guy you can maybe pick is Djokovic.
Yeah.
Anybody else to win it? I mean, who could you pick? I mean, like I said, there's a lot of these guys that I think can make a run. It could be in the semis. You know, Cilic, Delpo. You know, that it could be factors, but it's hard to pick those guys. I mean, if they're going up against Roger, so I'm going to go with Roger. I'm going to go out on a limb and say, you know, here's number
Roger
21.
Federer. Before I let you go, obviously we focus on the men, of course, because that's most of where your work lies, but the women's field will offer a lot of interesting storylines, including Simona coming off of winning her first. She said she didn't want to think at all about Wimbledon after winning finally her first Grand Slam. Sloane obviously had a good run. Maybe her game doesn't necessarily lend to the clay courts, but then a lot of question marks around Serena. And if she can get some of that momentum that it felt like she had, Patrick, in Paris, she could be a huge danger in week two.
Don't sell me short, Nick. I do a lot of women's matches.
I know you do.
I love it. I really enjoy it. And I think the women's, you know, game is flourishing. And, you know, there's a lot of great stories. And there's there's obviously way more possibilities of winners on the women's side than there are on the men's side, in my view. So Serena, let's hope she's healthy, and sounds like she is, and she can get back and be a factor. I do think that the grass, even though it's obviously her best surface over the years, or second best, hard court probably her best, I do think that there's a little uncertainty for her because of the movement, you know, early on. So you always find, you know, she put on a little weight, you know, obviously, understandably, and the quick movements necessary on grass where you don't quite have the time to set up. So that's going to be a little tricky, I think, for her. So, but if she can manage that and her quickness is back, you know, on clay, she had more time, you know, so the ball came to her and she had more time to set up. On grass, things happen a lot more quicker. The ball gets on you faster. You have to really move quicker and be extremely athletic, which obviously we know Serena at 100% can be that. I don't think she's going to be at 100%. Can she win at 80, 90%? Absolutely, she could. When you look at other potential winners, I mean, Kvitova, you've got to mention because she's always dangerous, loves playing there. Ostapenko, she's got the firepower, but she's been up and down this year. Sloane, you know, I wouldn't say no, just because, you know, she's such a clean ball striker, and and is such a great mover. But if she could take the ball a little bit earlier, a little bit more often, I think that would be beneficial for her. Keys, obviously a factor. Coco Vandeweghe, you know, she's been struggling recently, but she's done well before on grass. And then you've got, you know, the Ovas over there that, you know, Siniaková, and, you know, you have, there's all these coming out of the woodworks. They're solid players.
Yeah.
And some young players as well that, you know, Kazakhskina, you know, she'd be fun to watch on the grass.
Mm-hmm. Creative.
Yep, creative. Halep, I mean, look, you know, Halep, I mean, now that she's won one, she might just go out there and, you know, play unbelievable. You know, and just because she times the ball well enough, she doesn't have a big serve. But you don't need a big serve in the women's games to win it. It helps, but you don't need one. You can be a solid, you know, look at Kerber. She can certainly be in there. So there's a whole host of Pliskova has been, you know, I thought she'd win one maybe by now, but that hasn't happened. You know, you got Wozniacki. And so there's a lot, you know, there's 10, 15 women that you could probably win and maybe more.
The last two I want to mention is last year's final, Muguruza.
Oh, well, Muguruza, champion. Yeah. Well, she should be in right in there at the top.
She seems to get up for the big events. Yeah. And then also Venus Williams, who really hasn't had the year that
I mean,
think,
Venus would surprise me if she can make
it. It hasn't been there this year.
I mean, it's, you know, it's, I mean, she, well, age does catch up. I mean, it's amazing to still see Serena, Roger, you know, Venus. And what Venus did to get back to where she got, to me, was an amazing story. So could she get hot? Yes, I don't expect. And Muguruza, I think, is probably one of the favorites because I thought she played really well at the French. You know, just Halep just outplayed her in the semis, but she's got the strength and the game and the athleticism. So, you know, it's hard to think that she can't make a really big push again to win it.
Hmm. The men's winner may have been a little easier.
The men's winner is easier. The women's, you know. I'd like to pick an American just because I think, you know, a key, you know, I just don't know if Keys, does she have the consistency yet? She's done well. I mean, she's semis of the, you know, French was a great result for her.
Yeah.
You know, does she have the just
the final movement? At the U.S. Open last year, final, too.
She's been knocking on the door. I mean, nice, you know, maybe great. I mean, I wouldn't pick her. So if I'm picking, who am I going to pick? Muguruza, I don't know if she can win back-to-back.
I'm putting Patrick on the spot here, by the way.
Yeah,
we're about 10 days out from when.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, Kvitova.
Kvitova's a good pick.
Kvitova's a nice pick.
Think it'd be interesting to see if Halep steps out there.
I think Halep's going to play well. I mean, I really do. I think she's going to do well. So, and she can no pressure now. You know, she's done it. You know.
How about we'll leave it there? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate your time, and you can obviously hear Patrick's dulcet tones on the ESPN Wimbledon coverage.
I will be there for better or worse.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks so much to Patrick McEnroe for that chat. You can catch all of the coverage on ESPN for Wimbledon as the championships begin this next Monday. Let's move into our featured interview now with Steve Flink, our very own Hall of Famer, speaking with Yvonne Lendl.
I'm happy to introduce my next guest, who's one of the great players of all time and one of the standout U.S. Open performers as well. Yvonne Lendl set a record for the men in the Open era by reaching no fewer than 8 consecutive U.S. Open finals from 1982 to 1989. He won the tournament 3 times, captured 8 major singles titles altogether, finished 4 years at number 1 in the world, and secured no fewer than 94 singles titles across his distinguished career on the ATP Tour. Only Jimmy Connors and Roger Federer have won more tournaments in the Open era among the men. In plain and simple terms, Yvonne Lendl was an outstanding champion. Welcome, Yvonne, to the podcast. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Yvonne, you had a record of unassailable consistency at all of the majors, and you took 3 titles at Roland Garros, 2 more at the Australian Open. But in my view, you seem to play some of your most inspired tennis year in and year out at the U.S. Open. How do you feel about that, and what was it about the Open that brought out the best in you?
Well, Steve, I always liked playing in New York, and especially at the Open at Flushing Meadows. I lived in Greenwich, Connecticut, about 30 minutes away, and I was coming in only for the matches. I would come in one day the week before the Open for practice, and then just for the matches. So on my days off, I was able to stay home, and that's much more relaxing, keeps you a lot fresher. And on top of that, I think the surface fit me quite well.
Well, Yvonne, you also, you installed a DecaTurf 2 court at your home, did you not?
Yeah, I had identical court by the same crew done.
And what year? Do you remember the year that you had it installed and what kind of a, how significant?
Well, as soon as I moved to Greenwich and started playing the U.S. Open, so I would have it done first time in 1981.
So, Yvonne, the next year, of course, 82 is when this streak started. And to get to 8 consecutive finals was a testament to your dedication, your drive, your discipline. Let's start with that first final in 82 and that run to the final. You played really well against John McEnroe, beat him in straight sets in the semis. And many believed, I certainly did, that you were ready to win the title. But Jimmy Connors, who'd won Wimbledon earlier in the summer, beat you in 4 sets. What was the difference that day?
Well, first of all, you also need a little bit of luck to get to the finals and win majors. You need to stay away from injuries and stay away from long matches if possible and so on and so on. But Jimmy had a game which didn't suit me quite well early on, and he took big advantage of that. He would hit a forehand down the line. If I hit it cross court, he would take his backhand early and rush me a little bit, and it was not pleasant for me.
But you had beaten him in Cincinnati, I remember, quite handily, and played a brilliant match against him there and leading up to the Open. So you certainly had your share of success against him even before then. Was it partially also just, you know, this is your first Open final and some nerves?
I'm sure that plays a little bit of a part in it, but Cincinnati was totally different surface, was much quicker. You could overpower someone as at Flushing, you couldn't do that. It's also different, 2 out of 3, 3 out of 5, and with no disrespect to Cincinnati, there is difference between Cincinnati and U.S. Open.
Oh, absolutely. But you did manage to kind of get back into that match, Yvonne. You lost the first 2 sets, came back and won the third. At that stage, did you think that maybe you had a recovery in you that might be similar to what you had done against McEnroe to win your first major at Roland Garros in 84 when you climbed from 2 sets to love down and came all the way back to win? Did you have those types of thoughts when you won the third set against Jimmy at the Open?
Oh, it's hard to tell. Of course, I didn't have that experience of 84 French yet, but I have to say that Jimmy was the player who gave me the most trouble early on.
So, Yvonne, you had to play him again the next year, and I know that there were some circumstances there behind your loss, but you're 1-set all, 5-4 in the third, set point, and you double-faulted. And then from there, it just unraveled. And you said afterwards, you know, that if you do that, if you make a mistake like that, you don't deserve to win. You were kind of tough on yourself. But also, you were in a lot of physical pain and your cramps. Talk about what was going on that day that hindered you, because that was a difficult experience.
Well, I was just out of juice. I can't exactly remember what my tournament looked like coming into it in 1983 into the finals, but I ran out of juice and just wasn't able to do anything against Jimmy. I couldn't overpower him and I couldn't outrun him that day.
Was it painful to have that, to get a lot closer than you did the year before, be on the verge of 2-1 lead and not be able to exploit it and get the title?
It's always painful when you lose. You never take it and say, oh, that was fun. At least I didn't. In some ways, that match has helped me to realize how fit I need to be to compete at the highest level at all times. And about less than a year later, I started training differently and had different nutrition and so on and so on. And I just didn't want to repeat that experience that I lose because somebody just lasted longer than I did.
So was it a question of going into the gym a lot more? What did you change in the training regimen that the following year?
Well, I was looking at the last 3 years where after the French in 1984, I didn't feel very well in the summer. And so I started looking for things to get better, to get stronger, got a program from a track and field coach to get quicker as well. And I didn't like where my ranking was. I was kind of sitting always behind Jimmy or John, even if I was 2 or 3 in the world. I wanted to get to the top spot. And at that point, I also decided to talk to Tony Roach, and we worked together then after that for 10 years. And I have to give him a lot of credit for my success as well.
Absolutely. Tony Roach, of course, was the great Australian, won the French championships in 66 and was runner-up to Rosewall at the 1970 U.S. Open. Now, Yvonne, let's go to
He also was runner-up to Laver in 1969.
Yes, Laver at Wimbledon in 68, exactly.
And Laver at U.S. Open in 69.
Yes, exactly. In 69, Rod was completing the Grand Slam, and Tony won the first set. Long first set, looked like he might do it, and Rod came storming back to win. So,
and you know what happened there, right?
Well, Rod put on the spikes, and Tony didn't.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. Tony didn't have them, yeah.
Yeah. Did Tony tell you, did he regret that he didn't go to the spikes?
No, we never talked about it. I just saw it on some clips.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was a fine, obviously, he was a great coach for you and a great player. But, Yvonne, let's go to Super Saturday, 1984. You're part of one of the great days in tennis history, and I don't know whether it was something you stopped to reflect upon at the time or not, but you kind of opened the day after the senior final with Newcomb and Smith, and you came from match point down against Pat Cash. What are your recollections of that recovery and the great lob you played when you were down match point to come back and beat Pat Cash?
Well, he came in, and I hit an average pass, and I thought he was going to punch the volley away, and I didn't even have my racket ready properly. And then all of a sudden, I realized I can get it, and I lobbed him with a backhand grip on my forehand. That's what I remember from that.
And how did you execute it so well with the wrong grip?
I think you rely on your instinct and improvise. That's how the matches go most of the time anyway.
Yeah. So, Yvonne, before we get on to the final with John, have you thought since about the gratification of being part of such a great day? Because obviously it ended with McEnroe and Connors, and after your match, Navratilova and Everett played a great women's final. So it was a really spectacular day of tennis that many consider the greatest single day in the history of the sport. Have you thought about that in terms of your own involvement in it?
You know better than that, Steve. Obviously, I'm aware of that, but I'm not you know me well enough to know that I'm not a person who sits back and say, "Oh yeah, I was part of that."
Right.
Yeah, it's fun to kind of talk about it when somebody brings it up, but I do not sit back and think about it at all.
So, Yvonne, that was a difficult five-setter. McEnroe played Connors deep into the night, and yet he looked very fresh the next day. You had beaten him at the French, obviously, for your first major in the match we both alluded to. But what happened that day? Was it a case that John was just razor sharp and at his best serving and volleying and just all over you? Or were you disappointed in your performance? How did you feel about that one? Because John beat you
I remember
sense.
I was pretty stiff. I was not on top of my physical conditioning, and I think you have to realize that if you have two guys who are tired, the guy who is coming forward has bigger advantage, and John certainly made the best of it.
So a year later, Yvonne, there you are with John again. This time it was your day, your breakthrough. You played what many of us thought was maybe one of the best matches in your career, and I remember you said later that you thought you could make any shot, get to any ball. You had that feeling that day. Yet it didn't start that well. You were down 2-5, set point down on your serve, and you stormed back to win 7-6, 6-3, 6-4. How do you rate that performance so many years later?
Yeah, that was one of the few times I got into the zone. It's very difficult to get into the zone. If you talk to most people, they can tell you that they're able to get into a sub-zone. But into the zone itself, it's very, very difficult, and I was able to get there during that match. And you're right, I was down 2-5 and set point on my serve. And after that, I felt like I was flying out there. But I think we need to back up a little bit. Also, that summer I got beat by John in Montreal, and we had, I think, unfinished match, or he beat me in Stratton. And John had quite a good year that year, and So I think he came into the match as the favorite. Once I got ahead of it, as I said, I was in the zone and felt great.
And did you sense that maybe he was a little debilitated from his five-set match with Wielander, which was a very hot day the day before, or do you think that had little to do with it?
I have no idea. I didn't realize now, obviously, that he had played five sets until he told me, but I looked at it in the past, what the record is of the guys who play the first semis against the guys who play the second semis, and what the record is of the guys who play five sets against the guys who play three sets in the semis.
Yep.
And it's about 50-50.
That's true.
I don't think there is any distinct advantage, even though logic would dictate if you play first match and play straight sets and the other guy plays five sets and plays late, you should have the advantage, which could have been the case, the following year when I beat Machir after he beat Boris in five sets. I beat Stefan in the semis in straight sets, and Boris and Machir played five sets, and Machir won that, and he had nothing left. For every case like that, you can find another one which is opposite. It's the opposite.
But the bottom line is, as you just said, and I think most observers would absolutely concur, you were definitely in the zone in that final against John in 85.
Yeah, and it was fun.
So, Ivan, by 86, you really had clearly established yourself as the best player in the world. You seemed so comfortable having moved into that role and gotten to the top, and 85 Open was a turning point, and you just kept going, and you were having a great 86 season. And as you just alluded to, you beat Miloslav Machir really comfortably in the final after he had the long semifinal. Do you remember being particularly confident about defending the title no matter who you played that year? What are your feelings looking back on that one? Because I think it was sort of right smack in the middle of your prime.
Yeah, I think 86, 87 were my best years. And I wouldn't go and say I was extremely confident defending the title. I didn't even look at it like I'm defending the title. There is nothing you can do about the past, whether it's good or bad. There is only things you can do about your future. So why worry about the past?
Absolutely. But you did. You certainly came out ready to play in that final. And whether or not Machir was not 100% himself, you again looked like you were pretty much in peak form. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think I was ready to play pretty much the entire season. I was healthy. I was feeling good. I had great coaching. I had great training blocks. I had a good year.
So, Ivan, let's go to the next year, 1987. And now you're playing your formidable rival, Mats Wilander. You had a terrific rivalry with him. It was interesting contrast. Mats with his two-hander and his quickness and his counterattacking, and you trying to overpower him. And now you're playing him in the finals in 87 in a match that had been delayed by it rained out on Sunday. You're playing on Monday. And you were not feeling 100% by any means. Give me your thoughts on that contest.
Yeah, I think I was extremely fortunate that the match got delayed by one day, because I wasn't feeling well, and during the rain delay on Sunday, I just slept there. I had a pretty good case of the flu, and I felt a little bit better on Monday, and I was very lucky and very pleased that it didn't go five sets and that one of the sets was quick. Also, we played at night, which was a big advantage. If you don't feel well, it's easier to play later in the day than during the midday sun. And I was very lucky. That's what I was alluding to earlier, that in order to win, you also have to be lucky sometimes. In any match, and especially big match, if you split sets and you're going close to the tiebreaker or into the tiebreaker in the third, I think that's the most important juncture of the match.
So the following year, Ivan, you play Mats again, and he was having his greatest year, as you know. He had won two of the three majors. He'd lost at Wimbledon, but now he was trying to claim that U.S. Open crown, add that to his resume, and you guys had a titanic five-setter. Seemed to most of us, and I don't know how it felt to you on the court, Ivan, that Mats had made a shift in his game, and he attacked a lot more, came in 131 times to the net, and certainly tried to apply pressure in a way that to a degree we'd never seen before. Was that the reason he won? Was it that you were maybe not quite at your peak? It was a great match, 6-4 in the fifth to Mats. What do you remember about that one?
Well, I think the reason Mats won that match is because he played better than I did. It was a close match, and it was razors in margin. But I will have to say that this time I was prepared for him to be aggressive. Because he did that to me at the French Open in 1985, where I didn't expect it and caught me by surprise. So I knew that he is going to try to do that, because if he just stays back, the chances were that I was going to win somehow. So I was prepared for that. However, he did really well with his backhand slice. He hit some good volleys. I remember I missed some passes by inches. And as I said, it was razor thin, but the bottom line is he played a little better than I did. I thought it was a very good match.
Oh, it was. It was terrific. But you also kept fighting back, Ivan. He had just set in 4-1. You won the second set. He won the third, and he went up 4-3, 30-love in the fourth, and you came back and won that. And then finally, in the fifth, he had you 2-love, and you won three games in a row. It just seems like you were on the verge of it. With a little bit of luck, you would have won that match. Is that correct?
Well, I don't want to say that if I had a little more luck that I would have won. But as I said, it was really close, and he played really well under pressure.
So, Ivan, at 1980, the 80s closed with you playing a young man named Boris Becker, who you had a lot of respect for, mainly because of his awesome power, not just on serve, but off the ground. And he won in four sets and won a couple of critical tiebreaks in the first and fourth sets that made all the difference. What did you feel as you kind of, did you feel like you were staring into the face of the future? You seemed to have a lot of respect for Boris. He'd beaten you at Wimbledon earlier in the summer in the semis. You had a lot of great matches. You had more than your share of wins over him as well. But what did you sense that day about him and his how good he was at his zenith?
Well, I always thought Boris was a very difficult opponent to play because if he played his way into the tournament, he could be erratic. But when he played his way into the tournament, that means he was more consistent than on average day. And if you remember, he almost lost to Derek Rostagno that year.
Yes, yes.
Saved match points,
right.
At least one, if not two.
Yeah, two.
And
yeah.
Believe one of those was back and passed down the line, which clipped the tape over Rostagno racket. Match was almost over.
That's right.
Once he played his way into the tournament, he was very dangerous because of the power. And I felt with Boris, it was very difficult to control the points, that he was in control. He either hit winners or he made errors. Deeper into the tournament was more winners than less errors.
But you were known for your power too, Ivan. So was it that he had taken it to another level? Because you had done that to a lot of your rivals as you emerged, you know, years earlier. That you were.
Yeah,
able,
but
you,
now we're talking about 10 years later.
Yeah.
And it's different kind of power, and the serve was just brutal. He could just hit, toss it up four times, and balls were in your pocket again.
Following year, another big server came along, a young man that you had known and trained with a couple of years earlier named Pete Sampras. And he's the one that ended your streak of eight consecutive finals, which was a remarkable run. And it was a quarterfinal match, and you were down two sets, got it back into a fifth, and then Pete pulled away in the fifth set. Did you envision him becoming such a great champion at that stage? Where did you think he was headed? What were your impressions of Pete that day and what Pete was going to become?
Well, that was one match, Steve, where once I came back from two sets to love down, I thought I had an excellent chance of winning the match because of experience, because of conditioning, and so on and so on. However, Pete just played extremely aggressive and served incredibly in the fifth set. And that's why he won that match.
His serve was the difference in the fifth, you're saying. But did you envision him winning the tournament? And
I had no idea. I was so unhappy because of the losing that match that I didn't really bother. And, when I checked the next day, he won another match and then he won the final.
But you weren't shocked?
Well, when you get a young player, people put expectations on young players. And you never know how these players will react in certain situations till they get into those situations. And once again, it was not in my control, so I didn't worry about it too much. I wasn't shocked he won, and I wouldn't have been shocked if he got blown away either. So, you just don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. And how impressed were you with him, though, as you watched him dominate the 90s?
Oh, Pete was an incredible player. He was probably the best raw athlete I ever played against. I have played Pete a bunch of times, probably six or seven times. There were times when I thought I hit a topspin lob over his head, and he wouldn't even back up. He would just jump up and put it away.
Yeah, with that trademark leaping overhead, it was a great shot. So you would put his athleticism. I mean, obviously, Roger you observed Roger a lot. How would you compare his athleticism to Federer's?
I think Roger is a very different kind of player than Pete. He plays the game differently than Pete did. And all these guys are great athletes. I just think you know, it's hard for me to judge Roger because I have not been on the court against him.
But right, right.
As I say, Pete was by far or clearly the best athlete I ever played against.
So, Ivan, your open career concluded in 94. You had a remarkable success on those courts and at that venue. Did it ever bother you? It's hard for the public, hard to know as an observer, as a reporter from my standpoint or what the fans were thinking, but often you would play Connors, McEnroe. They were the Americans. You didn't become a citizen until 92. But how did you feel about the crowd reaction to you as a great player? Did you feel you were sometimes perhaps taken for granted?
Never really bothered with it too much. I mean, if you go and play a big event against any player in any country, you need to expect that the people are going to root for your opponent. If you play Davis Cup in Argentina, doesn't matter how popular you are there, they're still going to root for Jose Luis Clerc and Chile Mubila. However, if you play Davis Cup in Prague, I expect the people to support the home team. And that's what it is. If it was Czech Open, which was a major, and it was played in Prague, it would be the other way around for sure.
But as you look back, Ivan, at all those Opens, you know, and starting in 79 and ending in 94, is there one memory that stands out to you that might help the listeners in this podcast understand, you know, who you were and what you felt you stood for as a player? Because I know the players that you've talked about that you admired the most, and you talk about people like Labor and Sampras and the classy individuals. Is that the trait that stands out in your mind that how you wanted to convey yourself as a competitor?
Well, I think that's not a question for me, obviously. But what you want to do is you want to make it part of your game, and part of your, maybe intimidation is the wrong word, but part of your fear the opponents have that you never give up. And whether it is playing at the Open and losing two sets to love down to Pete and coming back, or as you mentioned, the match with Matt coming back all the time, or losing two sets to Vitas but still losing the match in five, I think that's what you want as a player, because you can live with no regrets. And I think the people remember that as well.
So is there one prominent memory that stands out for you that was most satisfying for somebody who won the tournament three times and did so well so many other years? Was it the first title? Was it the last title? What would you cite?
It's always the first title for me. I know Pete may tell you differently because his last title came at US Open very unexpected. At that time, he hasn't won in over a year, and all of a sudden he wins the US Open as his last match of his career. But for me, whether it was the French or the Australian or the ATP Tour or US Open, it's always the first one, because the first one is special. Now that we talked about it as well, I played a really good match against John, who was the favorite. I played in the zone and felt like I can do anything. And it was a fantastic feeling, and then winning on top of it.
So, Ivan, looking back, and I know it's hard to analyze yourself, do you feel like you were maybe one of the most transformational players we've had in terms of the style you developed with a big serve and inside-out forehand and a very powerful one-handed backhand that seemed to sort of set the trend, at least as I saw it, for future players? Is that part of your legacy along with the physicality and the training? How do you look at the way you may have shaped the sport with how you played and how you displayed it out at the U.S. Open?
It's hard to tell for me. I think the top players are always trendsetters in some way. They always figure out with whatever conditions or rules or equipment they're given how to play the best. And then a lot of players follow because they think that's the way. And then all of a sudden somebody else comes and improves on that. And then everybody tries to follow them and copy them and play like them because they think that's the way to go. And mine was power. And mine was power from the ground. And when I was 18 years old, never played an ATP Tour event. And my first tournament actually on the tour was the French Open. And I got a wild card and drew a qualifier. But qualifier happened to be a guy who just won two tournaments in a row on clay, Jose Luis Clerc.
Ah.
and Batata played very, very powerful game. And I knew I was equipped to play that game as well, with a little more speed, a little better serve, a little more touch, and better movement on the hard courts and indoors. And that's where I started going after it a little more being able to hit it with power but control it. A lot of players could hit it hard, but they couldn't control it. And I was one of the first few who could hit it hard and control it. But I did it by looking why did José Luis Clerc do so well when I couldn't even qualify for an event at that time yet.
Ron, any regrets about opportunities missed? I mean, you certainly, once you won that first French in 84, you really seemed to get much more comfortable about playing major finals, and it showed in that spree of three in a row at the U.S. Open. And do you have any regrets looking back about perhaps things you might have accomplished that you didn't, or are you very gratified about what you did achieve in your career?
I mean, you know, Monday morning quarterback is always very, very good. It's easy to say, hey, I would have done things differently, or I would have changed this, or I would have changed that. But you also have to keep in mind that you're making decision with certain amount of information. And if you get more information, you may make a different decision. If you get more experience, you may make a different decision. But given the decisions I made with the information I had at that time, I sleep well at night.
So, Yvonne, talk about the U.S. Open, how it's evolved, what it's become, what it became even after you last competed there in 94. You get back from time to time. Has the tournament exploded into a prominence that you might not have envisioned? What are your thoughts on the U.S. Open as it turns 50 this year, its 50th anniversary year?
Well, first of all, I get back every year. I'm there every year, whether I'm coaching or watching the juniors or whatever it is. I go there every year. I think that's an amazing, amazing number, half a century. Crazy when you think about that. And as far as the U.S. Open itself, I mean, it grew incredibly. USTA has done incredible job building the facilities, whether it is the stadiums, whether it is the locker rooms, and whether it is the restaurants and players' lounges and sponsor suites and so on and so on. I mean, it became a premier event in any sport. It's fantastic.
Well, Yvonne, you certainly made a major contribution to this tournament yourself with all of your great performances through the years, and of which you can be very proud. And I really appreciate your joining us today for this podcast. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Steve. You're very kind, and it was very, very fun, very much fun talking to you.
The U.S. Open comes around once a year, but you can stay up to date with the latest news every month. Visit usopen.org and sign up to be a U.S. Open insider. We'll send you the latest U.S. Open news, grounds updates, and be the first to know about U.S. Open ticket information. It's the perfect time of year. The U.S. Open is right around the corner. Sign up to be a U.S. Open insider at usopen.org. That's all we have for episode 12 of Courtside, the official podcast of the U.S. Open. You can find us on Spotify, iHeartRadio, on Apple Podcasts. You can also find us if you go to usopen.org. Thanks to Patrick McEnroe, Yvonne Lendl for chatting with myself, respectively, and Steve Flink. We'll be back for more after Wimbledon. And until then, thanks so much for listening to Courtside.